Hitler's War by David Irving. Pricking the Bubble. The dazzling heat of high summer had come to the Berghof. It was now early June 1941. The last echelon of assault troops had set out from Germany for the Eastern Front. In less than 3 weeks, Barbarossa would begin. It was time to start dropping hints to his prospective allies. Hitler asked the Duce to join him at the Brenner Pass on June 2nd, and talked alone with him for 2 hours before the two dictators were joined by their foreign ministers. When at 4 o'clock the train set out again for Berchtesgaden, Hitler sat with the Führer. He is contented, says Mussolini is very confident and sure of victory. Has dropped a hint about Russia, if the shipping losses alone do not suffice, that's the Hitler quote, meaning suffice to knock Britain out of the war. He had also mentioned to Mussolini the possibility that David Lloyd George might succeed a defeated Churchill. Then we must see what possibility there is of settling our differences. To the Japanese ambassador, General Ashima, whom he urgently summoned to the Berghof the next day, Hitler put on the appropriate anti-British act. After being lectured by Ribbentrop as well, Ashima cabled to Matsuoka in strictest confidence. Both gentlemen gave me to understand that a German-Soviet war probably cannot be avoided. Hitler bluntly stated that he would always be the first to draw his sword if he detected any hostility in an opponent, and although he did not expressly say so, his remarks to Ashima implied that while the Tripartite Pact was expressus verbis, not intended as an instrument against the Soviet Union, such was the obligation on Japan, and he would expect the Japanese to honor it. Ribbentrop assured Ashima that the Russian campaign would be over in 2 or 3 months. He could not say when it would begin, but if Japan should find it necessary to prepare for this eventuality, then he would advise her to do so in as short a time as possible. On June 4th, Hitler received King Boris of Bulgaria for 2 hours. Hitler took notes on the encounter, but they appear to have been lost. The Finns confirmed to German officers sent to Helsinki that they were aware of the historic hour that was dawning. Antonescu came to Munich and again offered to support the attack with all the military resources at Romania's disposal. The coalition was coming together well. Meanwhile, Hitler authorized orders to his Wehrmacht, which were so shocking that Keitel later had all copies of them destroyed. All political commissars attached to Red Army units, identifiable as such by the red star embroidered with a golden hammer and sickle on their sleeves, were to be executed on capture. Evidently, Hitler's dictation, Jodl drafted an explanation of the decision to liquidate these commissars. They, in particular, he said, would subject German prisoners to spiteful, cruel, and inhuman treatment, for they were the originators of these barbaric Asiatic fighting methods. Hitler ordered, if they are caught fighting or offering resistance, they are to be shot out of hand without exception and immediately. The role the Army General Staff, not to mention the German military lawyers, played in drafting these orders was less than glorious. Brauchitsch's staff had drafted 2 separate orders in weeks of tedious bureaucratic paperwork. The first was this commissar order, and the second an order restricting the jurisdiction of courts-martial on Russian soil. Hitler had always been irked by the ponderous procedures of the army courts, believing that only speedy conviction and execution was a true deterrent. It was Halder, however, who proposed the clause reading, "Immediate collective punishments will be enforced against towns and villages from which ambushes or treacherous attacks on the Wehrmacht are made, on the orders of an officer not less than battalion commander's rank, if circumstances do not permit the rapid arrest of the individual perpetrators." In the formal order issued by Keitel on Hitler's behalf in May, the Wehrmacht was instructed that offenses against Russian civilians would not be punishable, and that Frank's tireurs were to be wiped out in battle or trying to escape. To Hitler, the Red Army was not an enemy to be handled with kid gloves. In a conference on June 5th, He again warned his staff of the extensive use the Russians would make of tactics not sanctioned by international convention. Hitler anticipated that the Russians might, for example, contaminate their lines of retreat with poison gases, or use poisonous additives to spike the food stocks and fresh water supplies in the areas overrun by the Wehrmacht. Hitler had recently taken to gathering his friends, his adjutants, and their wives about him in the evenings and rambling on endlessly about Christianity and the Roman Empire. On June 8th, Huell entered in his Berghoff diary. Raining. The British are marching into Syria. A long conversation alone with the Führer about Russia. Says it will be a tough proposition, but he trusts in the Wehrmacht. Air Force. Numerical superiority in fighters and bombers. He is a bit frightened of air raids on Berlin and Vienna. The area we are to occupy will not be much bigger than from Denmark to Bordeaux in size. Russians have amassed their entire strength on their western frontier, the biggest concentration in history. If Barbarossa goes wrong now, we are all lost anyway. As soon as that is all over, Iraq and Syria will take care of themselves. Then I will have a free hand, and I will be able to thrust on down through Turkey as well. If the French lose Syria, and I am convinced that Syria is lost, then there is only one danger left, that they will lose Algeria as well. If that happens, I will thrust straight down through Spain at once and barricade the Mediterranean against the British. It is just this wretched waiting that makes one so nervous. End quote. A few days later, the OKW asked the Supreme Commanders for their views on a draft directive for the period after Barbarossa. Significantly, a contested invasion of Britain was not contemplated in this document. On the 11th, Hitler sent Schmundt to check if the headquarters being built for him near Rastenburg in East Prussia was ready. Something akin to hysteria was overtaking Moscow as the realization of Hitler's mobilization dawned. On June 9th, the German embassy in Moscow smuggled a naval officer into a Communist Party indoctrination session at which a functionary delivered a violently anti-German talk, warning his audience to be on guard over the next few weeks. The speaker said that nobody in Moscow had expected Hitler to conquer the Balkans so rapidly. For Bolshevism, the advantage was that any war of attrition must lead to the annihilation of the middle classes. The Soviet Union's interests would be best served by staying out while the rest of Europe bled white in war. Hitler arrived back in Berlin on June 13th, obsessed with the coming campaign. On that morning, the police raided every newspaper outlet in the capital and seized the latest Volkischer Beobachter, but enough copies escaped seizure and reached foreign correspondents and embassies for the impression to be conveyed that in Goebbels' leading article, E.G. Crete, he had unwittingly betrayed that within 2 months, Britain would be invaded. Goebbels was said to be in disgrace, but he was glimpsed the next day in Hitler's residence, cackling out loud over the success of this rumor-mongering. Hitler assured him his new campaign would be all over in a month. Goebbels suggested rather less writing. If ever an operation was a walkover, then this is. On June 15th, the Reich Chancellery was packed with the Wehrmacht commanders for a top-secret conference. Everybody was assigned different street entrances by which to arrive. Brauchitsch would arrive through the Garden Gate in Hermann-Göring-Strasse, Goering through Wilhelmstrasse, and the Army Group commanders through the new Chancellery in Vossstrasse. After lunch, Hitler called for silence and spoke of his military reasons for attacking Russia. An unpublished note taken by a Luftwaffe general survives. Hitler's after-luncheon speech. The main enemy is still Britain. Britain will fight on as long as the fight has any purpose. This is typical of the British, as we have seen from their individual soldiers. Conduct in Flanders, and it was demonstrated again by Dunkirk, by Greece, and by Crete. But Britain's fight only makes sense as long as they can hope that American aid will take effect and that they may find support on the continent. This explains why they have high hopes that the Russians will intervene and tie down the Germans, wearing down our war economy while the balance of power is tilted by American aid. At present, this is very meager. It will not become effective until the summer of 1942, assuming they have enough shipping tonnage to bring it over here, and the shipping losses are increasing. The proof of Britain's overtures to Russia is the complete uniformity in their press treatment of Cripps' journey. And there's an asterisk. Luckily, it's right next to us. All right. The British ambassador, Sir Stafford Cripps, had left Moscow a week before to consult with the Foreign Office in London. Continuing the quote, Russian's attitude is perpetually obscure. She exploited every moment of her political military preoccupation elsewhere to raise immediate political demands. We can see this happening in Russia's intervention in the Polish campaign and again against the Baltic states and Finland, and now in the Balkans, Bessarabia, and the Treaty of Friendship with Yugoslavia. Our attempt to clarify the position met with the following objections from Molotov. First question. What does our guarantee to Romania mean, and would we object to a Russian military mission? Second question, concerning the Dardanelles, and the third about Finland. In other words, continual efforts to muscle in somewhere. Since these efforts coincided chronologically with various temporary weaknesses in the German position, we would have to expect them to seize every chance they can in the future to act against Germany's interests. The Russian armed forces are strong enough to prevent us from demobilizing soldiers and feeding them into the arms and consumer goods industries so long as this latent Russian threat persists. Even if we made peace with Britain, this would still be so. We want this conflict to come early. However, indeed, it is absolutely vital if we are not to forfeit the favorable conditions that prevail. The bulk of the Russian forces are standing on the frontier, so we have a good chance of defeating them right there. Hitler rounded off his speech with a warning against underestimating the Red Army. Afterwards, he took Goering by the arm and soberly stated, Goering, it will be our toughest struggle yet, by far the toughest. Goering asked why, and Hitler replied, Because for the first time we shall be fighting an ideological enemy, and an ideological enemy of fanatical persistence at that. The familiar bouts of insomnia began to assail him. By night he lay awake and asked himself what loopholes in his grand design the British might yet exploit. He sent Field Marshal Milch on an extended tour of Germany's air raid defenses, suspecting that his successful paratroop operation against Crete might stimulate the British to undertake similar ventures against the Channel Islands as soon as his hands were tied in Russia. He had ordered the island garrisons increased and extensively reinforced, the more so as he intended to keep Guernsey and Jersey in German hands after the final peace treaty with Britain. On June 18th, with the newspapers of every country but Germany openly asking when Hitler's attack on the Soviet Union would begin, the Soviet ambassador in Berlin asked for an interview. Huell, at Hitler's chancellery, wrote an agitated note in his diary. Big problem. Vladimir Dekanozov has announced that he is to see the State Secretary Weizsäcker. What is he bringing? Is Stalin going to bring off a major coup even now? A big offer to us, etc., etc. Führer has a long discussion with the foreign minister. Engel, Hitler's army adjutant, and myself are going over every possible angle. The Führer and foreign minister will have to vanish, so they can't be reached. Much plotting. Sonnenberg, Karrenhall, or Berghoff. The train. Wild Park. And there's an asterisk, so I gotta interrupt this complicated note-taking. Let's go check it out. Sonnenberg was Ribbentrop's country home. Karrenhall was Goering's. Wild Park was the site of the Luftwaffe headquarters outside Potsdam. Okay. Then one day lying low in the Reich Chancellery. Hill concluded the entry as follows. These last days before an operation are the most nerve-wracking. The next evening, as Hitler was in the middle of dictating his Barbarossa proclamation, to the troops of the Eastern Front, Ribbentrop telephoned to report that Dekanozov had discussed purely routine affairs and had left after cracking a few jokes. Hitler's proclamation was a tour de horizon of Germany's foreign policy since the war began, but in its four closely printed pages there were some lines worthy of attention. Here Hitler claimed that the German people had never wished ill to the inhabitants of Russia. But for two decades, the Jewish Bolshevik rulers of Moscow have endeavored to set not only Germany, but all Europe alight. He said, too, that he had never tried to export the Nazi ideology to Russia the way that the Kremlin had tried to subvert the rest of Europe to communism. In a cynical oversimplification, Hitler reminded his troops, "You, my soldiers, know for yourselves that until a very few weeks ago, there was not one German panzer or mechanized division on our eastern frontier." The historic proclamation ended. Quote, "At this moment, soldiers of the Eastern Front, an assembly of strength the like of which in size and scale the world has never seen, is now complete. In league with Finnish divisions, our comrades are standing with the victor of Narvik, Dietl, on the shores of the Arctic in the north. German soldiers under the command of the conqueror of Norway, Falkenhorst, and the Finnish heroes of freedom under their own Marshal Mannerheim are protecting Finland. On the Eastern Front stand you, in Romania, on the banks of the Prut, and along the Danube, right down to the beaches of the Black Sea, are German and Romanian troops united under Antonescu, the head of state. When this, the greatest front line in history, now begins its advance, it will do so not just to provide the means of ending for all time this great war, or to defend those countries currently involved, but for the salvation of our entire European civilization and culture. German soldiers, you are thus entering upon a harsh and demanding fight, because the fate of Europe, the future of the German Reich, the existence of our nation, now rest upon your hands alone. May the Lord God help us all in this struggle." Huell wrote, "A long conversation with the Führer. Wishes he were 10 weeks on from now. After all, there must always be a big element of risk. We are standing outside a locked door. We will run into secret weapons. The tenacity of the fanatic, he now has to take sleeping pills to fall asleep. He is still dictating. He told me that this morning, June 20th, he again pored over every minute detail, but found no possibility for the enemy to get the better of Germany. He thinks Britain will have to give in, and he hopes it will be before the year is over." As recently as September 1940, the propaganda ministry had learned that Hitler had given the go-ahead for the Madagascar plan, under which about 3.5 million of the 4 million Jews currently living within his domain would be shipped to that island in the Indian Ocean a year or two after the war ended. Since that summer, his experts had been studying the possibility of resettling Europe's 10 million Jews on this large island, a French colony. Madagascar was over twice as big as Britain. Its pre-war population was 4 million. He did not want the Jews to remain in their present settlement region around Lublin, as historical experience showed that they would raise the danger of epidemics. On October 2nd, 1940, he discussed with Hans Frank and Balder von Schirach, Gauleiter of Vienna. Schirach had pointed out that his 50,000 Viennese Jews were due for deportation to Poland. Frank had protested that he could not accommodate any fresh influx. At first, Hitler had overridden his objections, but then the Madagascar solution had come under consideration. On June 2nd, 1941, Hitler and Mussolini... Oh, wait. I misread that. Hitler told Mussolini, "The island could not find room for 15 million people. The problem with this plan," he told Bormann, "was how to transport the Jews that far in wartime. I should dearly like to devote my entire fleet of the Kraft durch Freude, strength through joy, ocean liners," and there's a asterisk relating to the strength and joy ocean liners, "pleasure liners built for the mass German labor union, the DAF. Okay. Let's just reread that. "I should dearly like to devote my entire fleet of Kraft durch Freude, strength through joy ocean liners to it," he said, "but I don't want my German crews being sunk by enemy torpedoes." In private to Keitel, Bormann, and Speer, Hitler described it as his ultimate ambition to eliminate all Jewish influence throughout the Axis domains. Their presence still caused countless bureaucratic vexations. On June 7, 1941, Dr. Hans Lammers wrote to Bormann, "The main reason why the Führer has not approved the ruling proposed by the Ministry of the Interior is that in his opinion there won't be any Jews left in Germany after the war anyway." The coming occupation of new territories in the East suggested to Hitler an alternative solution of the Jewish problem. As Operation Barbarossa approached, it suggested itself to him that the new Eastern Empire would enable him to overcome Hans Frank's loud objections to the dumping of Jews on his general government territory, and Himmler's growing influence there. 3 days before the Wehrmacht attacked Russia, Hitler announced this explicitly to Frank, and the latter accordingly briefed his staff that no fresh ghettos were to be established, since the Führer expressly stated to me on June 19th that in due course the Jews will be removed from the general government, and that the general government is to be, so to speak, only a transit camp. In the view of Dr. Goebbels, who sat in on these discussions on June 19th, this deportation to the East would be a fitting punishment for these troublemakers, and one which the Führer himself had actually prophesied to them. So there's all these plans being made to get rid of Jews, and he's even talking about holding them until after the war and then dumping them somewhere. But obviously he just murdered them all in gas chambers, right? 7 months later, the Madagascar plan died a natural death. A foreign ministry official would write, "The war against the Soviet Union has meanwhile made it possible to provide other territories for the final solution. Accordingly, the Führer has decided that the Jews are not to be deported to Madagascar, but to the East." 2 days remained, and Russia was still an enigma behind a sealed door. During a coffee break snatched with his female secretaries in their stair cupboard in the chancellery, Hitler noted that there was something sinister about the Soviet Union. It reminded him of the ghost ship in the Flying Dutchman, which I think is a film. "We know absolutely nothing about Russia," he said. "It might be one big soap bubble, but it might just as well turn out to be very different." At 9 p.m. on Friday, June 20th, Colonel Schmunt, his Wehrmacht adjutant, brought news from the Admiralty. A German submarine had proudly reported attacking the U.S. battleship Texas since it was encountered 10 miles within the North Atlantic blockade zone proclaimed by Germany. As recently as June 6th, Hitler had reiterated to Admiral Raeder why he wanted to avoid incidents with the United States. Raeder now argued that the U-boat had acted correctly, but proposed forbidding attacks on U.S. ships up to 20 miles inside the blockade zone. Hitler at first agreed, but during the night he had second thoughts and telephoned the Admiralty that there must be no incidents whatsoever involving the United States until the outcome of Barbarossa was clear. The same order was issued to the Luftwaffe. Less than 12 hours remained before the attack. He summoned Goebbels and paced the long chancellery drawing room with him for 3 hours, examining from every angle the risks involved in Barbarossa, and pondering on Britain's future. Why, for instance, was Mr. Churchill still systematically playing down Hess and his peace mission? The foreign ministry telephoned that the Soviet ambassador was again urgently demanding to see Ribbentrop. Dekanozov was fobbed off with word that Ribbentrop was away until evening, and that an appointment would be made on his return. In fact, he was at the chancellery and paid several visits to Hitler. He cabled orders to Ambassador Schulenburg in Moscow to destroy the embassy's codebooks and to seek an immediate interview with Molotov. At this, he was to read out a long rigmarole ending with the words, "The Führer has therefore ordered the German Wehrmacht to confront this menace with all the means of force at its disposal." At 9:30, Dekanozov was allowed to see Baron von Weizsäcker to general relief. He was only delivering a formal Soviet Union complaint about the repeated German violations of her airspace. The parallel complaint delivered simultaneously to Schulenburg in Moscow evoked much hilarity when it arrived in Hitler's chancellery in the small hours of the morning. "A series of symptoms gave us the impression that the German government is dissatisfied with the Soviet government," grumbled Molotov. Hitler saw Goebbels off the premises at 2:30 a.m. It was now June 22, 1941, the anniversary of Napoleon's attack on Russia. "He has been working on this since July," Goebbels observed in his diary, "and now the hour has struck. 1 hour later, along a frontier extending from the Arctic Ocean to the Black Sea, 3 million German and coalition troops attacked Stalin's empire. Surprise was complete. Hitler briefly retired to bed, remarking to his adjutants, "Before 3 months have passed, we shall witness a collapse in Russia the like of which the world history has never seen." What Hill described as a tranquil, self-possessed mood descended on the chancellery during the morning. It was like any other Sunday, except that Hitler and Ribbentrop fell fast asleep after lunch. Hitler's adjutants, wilting under the Central European sun, went swimming. Italy had honored her obligations with notable speed, cabling at 3 p.m. that she regarded herself as being at war with Russia. Romanian troops had crossed the Prut and were fighting in the provinces invaded by Russia 12 months before. Madrid telephoned that a volunteer legion was being recruited to join the crusade. An ecstatic Admiral Horthy exulted to the German ambassador in Budapest that he had dreamed of this day for 22 years. Mankind would thank Hitler for centuries to come. He broke off diplomatic relations with Moscow, but this was as far as he would as yet go. At 6 p.m., a disappointed General Jodl telephoned his liaison officer in Budapest, but Horthy had gone off to play polo. His chief of army staff was unavailable, and the defense minister had gone fishing. Just as Hitler expected, the Hungarians, canny as ever, wanted to see the first results of Barbarossa. The bulk of the Russians' forward air force had been smashed on the ground on this first day. Over 1,200 Soviet craft had been destroyed. On June 23rd, Huell wrote, 11:30 a.m., the Führer is in a brilliant mood on account of the huge successes in Russia, Luftwaffe. As so often before, Hitler and his staff drove through the sun-drenched streets of Berlin to his special train. At 12:30, he left for East Prussia, the twin locomotives hauling him through those fields and cities so recently liberated from the Poles. Over tea, he reminisced with Huell and the others. Russia, he conceded at one point, is still a big question mark. Long after midnight, he was in a column of automobiles being driven past cordons of sentries guarding a wood about 10 miles outside Rostenburg, deep inside which was his new headquarters. During the train journey, he had decided to call it the Wolf's Lair, Wolfschanze, whatever. "Why Wolf again?" asked Christa Schroeder, just like the other HQs. Hitler replied, "That was my code name in the years of struggle." It was 1:30 a.m. as he set foot inside the forbidding compound. From here, he planned to command the defeat of the Soviet Union. Oh, I finished the chapter. I'll pat myself on the back.